Blog Talk Radio.
He is the last of his kind. All that remains of a once powerful nation. Some think he is a myth. Some believe he is the chosen one, who will bring balance to a world at war. And some will stop at nothing to destroy him.
Welcome, Morris. Morris Talk Live 100. I'm your host, Tahaka Amano Elbe. And this evening, we will be dealing with Morris and the power of having your own schools. Having your own schools. We got some very important information lined up for you in that regard. Why should Morris have their own school? What is the benefit of Morris having their own schools? How should these schools be structured? How should these schools be funded? Should these schools only contain students of African descent? Should the teachers only be of African descent? Should these schools refuse any government funding at all? How should these schools be protected? Should these schools be private? Who was Nat Turner? We're going to deal with that this evening. But before we get started, ladies and gentlemen, let me remind you that we will be offering my free articles this evening, the 14th Amendment Exposes Wealth as a Commerce Game and How to Play, and also Secrets of America. The way to access that is simply contact me, Tahaka53@hotmail.com, and I will rush that information to you. Now, the information that we're going to deal with this evening is very, very vital, and I cannot stress that enough. I have created a library, and this library is specifically designed to aid people in helping with your culture, your story, law. There's tons and tons of information in there for you, and I want to commend the brothers and sisters that accessed the archives today, who are well on their way to solving the problems, the stuff that they're having in their lives, dealing with the mortgage companies, the bankers, the sheriff department, the warrants, all of this stuff is available to you. And what we do once you get that is we walk you through that, and we help you with it. You got the tools in your hand, and then we'll show you how you use them. Now, I'm going to be putting all access to all of that information in the archives this evening. And I want to also say, for those of you who would like to dial into the broadcast, you can dial 310-982-4184. If you got a question or comment as we go along here this evening, go ahead and raise your hand, and I will open up the line so that you can let us know what's on your mind or whatever comment that you have. We're going to redo something that we've already done. As a matter of fact, I think I'll go ahead and do that. That'll give me a chance to put some stuff into the chat room. And the chat room is open. But before I do, I want to make mention of the fact that in August, on the 16th to 18th, we'll have the Morris Summit 2 right here in Jacksonville, Florida. So you all can come down and find out what we're doing, and we'll be able to show you what we're doing here in involving our gardening system and structuring and transforming a neighborhood into a community. So right here on August the 16th through the 18th, be here in Jacksonville, Florida, so you can look at this thing, okay? And if you need any information about how to get here or what's going on, just simply call me at area code 904-303-9061, okay? All right. We're going to go ahead and start, and y'all pay attention to what we got to do here.
And realize that the missing link in everything that we try to do, Claude, is the absence of the proper mindset. How do we get the proper mindset into our people? I teach at our school that no slaves were ever brought to America. That human beings were captured and brought over here, sold into bondage, and through a diabolical process converted into slaves. And then that diabolical process involved the emptying out of those things that constitutes a person's humanity, and then replacing that with some other garbage that would give sustenance to this new creature called a slave. That is a mind process. You use beating on the body to effectuate the mental change, but the change has to take place in the mind. While we have been set free legally from physical bondage, no process has ever been instituted by which to disengage the effectiveness of that previous process which produced the creature in the first place. So we have bodies running around talking about things, but our mentalities are still back there as the result of what was done to us in order to convert us into that slave. The slave-making process, do not kid yourself, was a mental thing. So unless and until we reinstill into our people the right mindset as to who they are, from whence they came, and why they are here and what they've got to do, we will continue to have dirty glasses to complain about. So we're here to put down or start the process of putting down the clean glass. I want to say one last thing, and that is that no event of any scale or scope, even a Million Man March, no event can undo the damage and the harm done by a process. We didn't submit to being slaves overnight. It took generations. I think Claude estimated 8 or 10 generations for them to convert us from the Africans we were to the slaves that we became. What makes us think that any single gathering, including this one today, by and of itself, is going to undo all of that damage and all that harm? But the journey of 1,000 miles begins with the first step, somebody said. So today is that first step in that journey to start that process, to effectuate the process, which will undo the damage, remove the garbage that was put into our people during that other process, and go through another process of refilling us with the essence of what our Creator God invested us with in the first place. And that was a wise Father, Mother, God that saw fit to do that. And we are made in the image and likeness of that that created us.
Right.
So we have to do the same thing here in the earth realm.
And I think that this type of education that we're talking about comes first, because we do have a lot of wealthy black people. Just look at all your athletes and entertainers. But none of them have any conscious mindset, whatever. So you got all this money and all this exposure and all this communication that goes to waste because they don't have any backing behind it. Whereas you have Arabs and Asians and people like that that come over here, they come over here with the education that they got from where they come from, and they're doing it for their own personal reasons, like everything we do. You know, even you guys here today are doing this because you have a personal drive to do it, and your personal drive just happens to be black people. Well, their personal drive happens to be their nation. They come over here to use this economic power to better their nation the best way they can, whatever. And they're going to try and take and drain America for all this milk, whatever, and go back to wherever they go, and they're going to try and make their people the paramount leaders inside the world. Well, that's why I think education is still so important, because we have a lot of people who we can get to do the same thing, but they're not thinking along the right lines to get that to happen. That's why meetings like this are so important, whatever. And it's even more important, rather than trying to get people that are already rich now to do things for us, because they've already been educated to the point a lot of times where this black stuff doesn't make any sense to them. But you do have a lot of young people who are still fresh and raw, open and susceptible to these type of teachings, who are just waiting to be swayed one way or the other. They can go down that path, this path, or the other path, because they don't know yet. So that's the thing that I think you really need to stress, is trying to get young people to understand this type of curriculum more. And if you have schools, whatever, that you can teach it through, that's good. If you have your own children, I think it's good for them to come to these type of events, so they can see people and they can form their own views and opinions and mix that with their more modern technological inclinations, whatever. So you have a new breed of nationalists, not necessarily the kind that have to get out on the streets and boycott and hand out flyers to get everything done, but they can get on the internet and light up the email system and make sure with the click of a button 10,000 people get a notice for something. So I think that's what we really need to focus on. Thank you.
Okay, Moses, we're back. Now, we have a young man that gave us his opinion on how he think things ought to go. But what we want to take a look at is, and I'm not sure if everybody inside the United States is aware of a fact, that there is a school. And we want to let's go inside that school and take a look around and find out what exists already inside the United States. What we got going here? Okay, let's take a look and see what we already got going inside the United States in regards to people of African descent having their own schools. Now,
they are the children. Mainstream Palm Beach County public school teachers allegedly didn't want to teach.
All I had was my mother worried, you know, other people, you know, worried about whether am I going to make it in the school system or not.
Once that child has a label in your traditional schools, they do not attempt to educate that child.
Now remember, it's not west-south, it's south-west.
Negative labeling of their children plus low expectations equals frustrated parents.
Okay, the minute they don't know a material or a certain material, they have to be labeled.
But thanks to a new school and some dedicated educators, these children are rejecting negative labels and are standing on the shoulders of their ancestors to reach the top. Stay with us for the next hour as we examine the remarkable journey of children, parents, and educators who are reaching new heights from the bottom rung of the educational ladder.
I'm William Giles. Charter schools are a relatively new concept throughout America. People both inside and outside of education still debate the need for such schools. Indeed, many charter schools have already failed in their short lifespan. Add to that the concept of an African-centered charter school, and the difficulties multiply exponentially. That possibility was not lost on the founders of the Joseph Littles and Guzu Saba Charter School in West Palm Beach. But as we learn throughout this presentation, Joseph Littles and Guzu Saba is realizing some great successes, and many parents are forever grateful the founders fought and continue to fight hard to keep the school operating.
It says in the blue line, a line of the cemetery, which is yes or no.
At 7 o'clock in the evening, the Hobbs household in Riviera Beach is quiet, but very busy. After preparing dinner, LaShawn Hobbs, a single mother of six school-aged children, works studiously with each child until every page of homework is finished. Except for weekends, this is a daily ritual in the Hobbs household. LaShawn Hobbs vigilantly practices parental involvement in her children's education with a clear understanding that that's the only way for them and her to have a future better than their past.
Oh, it's going to be excellent. It's going to be, you know, outstanding. Because now it's like, okay, I got them on the right track. And then between home and at school.
For Hobbs, the right track means taking all of her children out of Palm Beach County's mainstream public schools and enrolling them in the Joseph Littles and Guzu Sava Charter School in West Palm Beach.
Yes, Jaisha? His background, and what would his background be telling us, Akini?
Joseph Littles and Guzu Sava is an African-centered charter school that focuses not only on excellence in academics, but also building character and good citizenship first and foremost. The school is a godsend for the Hobbs family and most other families who have enrolled their children at Joseph Littles and Guzu Sava.
And I think the parents, too, needed something to believe in. And they believed that we were there to save their children and to care for their children. One of the things that we have always done from our beginning days is nurture our children. We don't have a policy like I understand they have in some schools that you can't touch the children. And the parents could see the love coming from us.
We have children that come to us that haven't slept all day, all night, that have two or three people coming in out of the home all times of night, come from domestic violence situations. Sometimes they come from situations where they have been exposed to abuse, physical and mental abuse, and they try to bring this baggage into a new environment on a Monday morning, and everything's supposed to be all right, and they mentally can't process all this and know that it's not their fault. So they start acting out in the public schools that tends not to be as sympathetic and not as accommodating, and they fail miserably.
I got six.
Before enrolling her children in Joseph Littles and Guzu Sava, Miss Hobbs swirled around in a downward spiral of despair and a sense of helplessness as the Palm Beach County Public School System classified her children with learning disabilities, a stamp that typically spells a bleak and sometimes disastrous future for children well into adulthood.
Once that child has a label in your traditional schools, they do not attempt to educate that child. What they do attempt is to keep that child in some sort of controlled environment so that they do not hurt themselves or have a chance to hurt anyone else. Those kind of children would generally be written off, and they would eventually end up being the ones who are on the streets trying to hustle drugs, pimp women, snatch pocketbooks, jack cars, and all of the other sorts of antisocial behavior patterns that none of us would like to see people engaged in, and certainly none of us want to be victimized by.
Miss Hobbs' 13-year-old son, Robert, was too young to understand the consequences or even why he was labeled with a learning disability while attending a local mainstream elementary school, but what he could understand was that it was having a very disturbing effect on his family.
As a youngster, I didn't really know what it was. I only understood it when I got, like, older, what I was labeled for. But when I was young, you know, all I had was my mother worried, you know, other people, you know, worried about whether am I going to make it in the school system or not.
The first piece of material that a teacher gives the students, okay, the minute they don't know a material or a certain material, they have to be labeled, which I don't think that's, you know, that's not right. But at a charter school, it's more like, okay, they don't see that. They don't see it, and they see it. But they're not going to label a child. What they're going to try to do, instead of labeling that child, they're going to try to make some progress.
These children are, for all practical purposes, kind of kicked to the curb, and they're allowed to kind of flounder around in the system until finally they're filtered out. Our philosophy is that these children can learn, and we have to be sensitive enough to find ways to reach them. And with that, they can not only make it, they can succeed and excel.
I am somebody. I may need to study hard. I may need to read more. I may need to watch TV less. But I am somebody.
At administrators, teachers, and staff at Joseph Little's in Guzusaba work diligently to reverse what they perceive as damage caused by the public school system's labeling process. At the beginning of every school day, each teacher simultaneously engages the children in a ritual known as Umoja time.
Glory and suffering for our ancestors.
And honor the struggles of our elders.
And honor the struggles of our elders.
Umoja time consists of a litany of Afrocentric pledges and songs, combined with the Pledge of Allegiance to the American flag and the singing of the Black National Anthem.
Lift every voice and sing.
The recitals and songs are designed to build character and self-esteem, in keeping with the school's mission to provide each student with opportunities to become the very best human being he or she can become. Umoja is one of the seven principles of Kwanzaa, an African-centered holiday which sets forth rules for
embrace and to embody these principles, not just learn them by rote and be able to repeat them, but in fact to have them become a part of the very essence of them.
We believe these children have to understand that they have to have order in their lives. They have to understand that we as teachers and administrators and board members not only have them their names and a number on a piece of paper, but we know who they are and they can sense that we care about them. And we have expectations. We don't expect a child to just maintain or just be normal. We expect them, we set the bar high. We expect for them to reach for the bar instead of lowering the bar to what certain stereotypes say they should be.
We try to build the character of these children so that we can get away from all the negative feedback that black children get and black parents get as far as not wanting to be a part of their child's education and the children not wanting to learn or not being able to learn. Get away from always being labeled as SLD or ESC when sometimes the child might just need a chance to get into a smaller classroom and just be noticed.
The children appear to be very receptive to the school's strict rules and guidelines. At Joseph Little's in Guzusaba, you won't see any sagging pants and exposed underwear, nor will you see midriffs or skirts that are too short, a remarkable phenomenon in a time when children are heavily influenced by today's powerful hip-hop culture.
Once you line up, you're supposed to be in the honor position. There should be no talking. Am I correct?
As teachers escort their classes throughout the school building, the children are asked to form what is known as the honor position, which entails the children quietly lining up in single file with their right hand gripping the left in front of their bodies.
What I need you to do is time for lunch. We're going to line up quietly in the honor position. Thank you very much, boys and girls. Quietly in honor position.
The honor position is not a submissive posture. Instead, it teaches the children to respect their elders and fellow students at all times. The seven principles of Nguzusaba are also having a positive effect beyond school hours. Many parents are noticing a difference at home as well.
A lot of times at home, if I'm dealing with a situation in my house, I might refer to one of those rules and ask him what is the meaning of that rule, and they'll tell me what the meaning of the rule is, and I ask him what part of that rule are you breaking, and they'll tell me, and then a lot of times they might come, "Ooh, mommy, she's breaking this rule and that rule," and to me it makes a big difference because those rules are so important, and they're so good at helping you build the character of your children.
I'm impressed. I appreciate the school a lot because they have made a lot of differences in as far as my children's education, as far as our family living, as you know, as us being working together, and by them having a total different outlook on their attitudes and their prosperities and so forth. So
I think there's so much more proud of themselves when they hear people talking when they hear negative words like nigger and the different languages that they use these days to describe each other, like the negative rap artists, the way they rap and stuff. I think my children don't care to listen to that stuff anymore. It plays a big part. I mean, such a big part in them.
When I first came to Just Littles, I was very hyper. And Ms. Gayuka started to put me in different activities so that I can get rid of some of my energy. As I got rid of some of my energy, I began to become smarter academically. And I began to make my mom proud of me. And one day, my mom asked me this one question: what do you want to be when I grow up? I said, I'm going to have to think about that. And I have that question. I have the answer to that question. I want to join the Air Force when I grow up. And I realized that people just don't wake up and say, oh, I want to be this, I want to be that. They work hard at it. And that's what I'm doing here at Joseph Littles.
The impetus for an African-centered charter school actually began about a decade ago, more than 1,000 miles from the turquoise blue surf and the swaying palm trees of Palm Beach County. It was a period when African Americans across the nation were frustrated by increasing violence, a bleak economic outlook, and deteriorating neighborhoods. More importantly, many African Americans were coming to a realization they couldn't depend on their political and educational leadership to create improvement opportunities in their communities. Until one African American spiritual leader led a new charge.
On October 16, 1995, Minister Louis Farrakhan, leader of the Nation of Islam, had summoned more than 1 million black men from throughout the world to Washington, D.C. for what was known as the Million Man March. In his sermon, Minister Farrakhan urged the pilgrims to return home and do something to take control of the destiny of their own communities.
In Guzosaba Charter School? Yes, sir.
Among those profoundly inspired by Farrakhan's words was Amafika Gayuka, who had traveled to the nation's capital from Palm Beach County. After returning home, Gayuka was uncertain just what he would do to help uplift the black community, but he knew he would do something. Gayuka was serving on the Board of Commissioners for the Palm Beach County Housing Authority when it finally occurred to him what his mission would be.
And so I suggested to my fellow commissioners that one of the things that we might want to consider is that insofar as residents and children who reside in public housing are disproportionately to be found among those who are engaging in, shall we say, less than desirable habits and practices, that we as a commission should feel a correspondingly disproportionate responsibility for finding some solutions to the problem. And that one approach we might undertake is to pursue a charter, to operate a charter school for the students who resided in our units.
One of the things that we expected from the Housing Authority was that they would be a natural partner, that they would have the alliance that would allow us to build the school system, the charter school, from the ground up, seeing that they already were serving the same population in terms of providing shelter for them. We wanted to educate those same children. So that's like a natural partnership. And one of the things that happened, for whatever reasons there had to be some political administration reasons, that we were not able to gel that partnership. And I believe that was one of the earliest challenges that the school faced, and not being able to gel that relationship.
In fact, resistance from the Housing Authority was the first in a long line of challenges Gayuka and the other founders would face after the school opened some 5 years following the Million Man March. It should be noted that although inspired by the Million Man March, the Joseph Littles and Guzu Sabo Charter School is not affiliated with the Nation of Islam. Joseph Littles and Guzu Sabo was among the first charter schools granted in Palm Beach County. During that time, the new concept of charter schools was already drawing fire from some opponents who believed charter schools would drain coveted funds from mainstream public schools. Starting an Afrocentric charter school was like pouring gasoline on the fire.
When you add to that the element or the idea of an African-centered charter school, you are probably at minimum quadrupling the degree of difficulty involved
because, first of all, there are not that many folks around this part of Florida who can identify or will identify with the ideology of Afrocentricity or African-centeredness, if you will. And at the same time, there are those who might be inclined because of their genuine concern.
All right. There you have it. Now, what we have is people inside the United States of African descent have actually put this thing together and done this. So that my reason for bringing this to the forefront is to show you that it is possible. And if it is possible, it is possible on an international scale. Let's continue. We
to help black people better themselves who would like to do something like that, but who are just convinced that the system, as it were, would never permit a charter to be let for anyone to openly and above board operate a school that unabashedly claims itself to be African-centered.
It was a time when we were trying to pull together everything that we needed for the school, but the community wasn't ready for this concept. First, charter schools, the idea of charter schools was new to the community, period. Then the idea of an Afrocentric charter school just didn't fare well. I think the community felt that charter schools would take away from the money that was meant for public schools. The community also felt that having a school that dealt with Afrocentricity was somewhat radical.
Co-founder Betty Dawson has worn many hats at Joseph Littles in Guzu Saba since the school's inception, including assistant principal and director of curriculum. Her current role is testing coordinator. This retired public school administrator bought into the idea of an African-centered charter school immediately, and at the time thought many of her fellow retired black educators would jump at the opportunity to help create such a school. Dawson and many others believe those former public school teachers would be natural allies of the school. They were wrong. Gaining support from retired African-American educators proved to be a challenge almost as great as winning a charter itself.
We did have, at the beginning, we had retired teachers, and administrators working with us. And I had a group of teachers who helped me write a curriculum. But as we got closer to the time that the school was going to open, everybody disappeared. And I was left, the only one of the retired teachers left working with the school.
The response was totally negative. The response was more of that of what we'd call the brainwashed black person who would say, these children are not mine, they can't make it. It's like they're the downcast, they're the thing we're trying to erase out of our history, they're the ones we want to get away from.
And this is what's the perception of black educators?
Black educators, retired black educators, the initial approach was to black educators that retired and said, would you like to come and help these children? And their response was, I don't want anything to do with them.
The Joseph Littles and Guzu Saba Charter School eventually opened in 1999, but adequate staffing remained a big problem in the early days. Charter board members and school administrators were forced to make do with the staff they had available to them at the time.
I know I had a task of trying to make these, help these teachers develop. I did some staff development workshops. But it still seemed to be a real challenge to get the teachers really motivated in terms of the curriculum, the Afrocentric curriculum, and also in terms of classroom management, in terms of doing things that teachers are expected to do in the classroom. And quite frankly, on their behalf, they were not really trained. They didn't have the certification, did not have the teaching experience. So you really were trying to bring teachers up to par. At the same time, you have students that are disadvantaged. And so that was a challenge. But I think we worked with what we have.
So if you want around here and say value, okay, that's what we're going to be doing.
Joseph Littles in Guzu Saba now has very dedicated professional faculty and staff who are determined to help the school grow. One reason administrators and charter board members believe many people didn't support Joseph Littles and Guzu Saba in the beginning is that many people failed to understand the concept of an Afrocentric school.
Many people who are not black misinterpret what we're doing. To say it's racist or separatist, it's not. We're just trying to do basically the same thing that many other ethnic groups already do in the society. Look at the Jewish community. Jewish community have done an excellent job in keeping the roots of their history with their people and passing on to the next generation and that responsibility to your people.
We operate from the premise that the most African-centered thing that we can do is to be excellent every day. The most African-centered thing that we could do is be excellent every day and do right by each other.
I think like any school, we fight the same battles, but sometimes I think some of the battles that we fight are not battles that we inflict on ourselves. I think it's just people who have lack of knowledge and don't really know what the school is about, and they say negative things about the school without even investigating what the real deal is, and they're trying to hinder us in that way.
Joseph Littles and Guzu Saba Charter School teaches children to embrace their black heritage. Images of African culture permeate the entire school, from the headmaster's office to the student bulletin boards.
And unify our homeland.
We will raise many.
Students are exposed to ancient African customs and traditions, which are credited in large part for remarkable academic improvements at the school.
The environment is so conducive. The children are pumped up. You know, it's not, you're going to do good. You don't even have an option. You know what I'm saying? And that's what I want, because we have the resources to send our children anywhere, you know. If it's conducive to their learning, you know, that's where we want them to go. And this is really, I mean, I've seen so much improvement with my children.
I think after the first 5-6 months with some of the students in this school, there was traumatic changes in their behavior and attitude towards learning. It's amazing how fast these children responded to a soft voice and a hug or a handshake or just a pat on the back. Their attitude changed. It was almost like overnight.
Yes?
Exist?
Yes?
Exaggerated?
Uh-huh.
Extra.
Mm-hmm. Yes, good. Any more? The proof is in the children's faces that you see every day. You can have people come up and say, there's not enough that I can say, but the proof is in the children's faces that you see every day.
The proof is in more than just the children's faces. It is in their schoolwork, their attitudes, and perhaps most importantly, their test scores. With children who were failing miserably in traditional public schools, Joseph Littles was expected by many to be a failing school with a grade F rating. And because it was taking in the school district's absolute lowest academic achievers, Joseph Littles and Guzu Saba was never expected to rise above such a low grade level. But administrators, board members, faculty, and parents wholeheartedly rejected those expectations and instead raised the bar for their children. The results were astounding.
One of the surprising things to most people, except me, was that our children did as well as they did on the most recent FCAT. Our children earned a strong D, and that was the very first grade that we received on the FCAT, contrary to what the newspaper was publishing. And it
okay, Moses. Now, this is very, very interesting. And if you can use your imagination for a moment and just think what it would be like to begin to set these up all across the United States. This is what's going on. If you think, just think for a minute. In Korea's been in the news here lately. What type of integration you think is going on in there? None. What type of school system you think they got going in China? Everybody in there is Chinese. I mean, this is not hard. It's not complicated. It's not hard.
Strong D, that we're told we only missed getting a C by about 24 points, which means that our children had to perform in an exemplary fashion, especially in what is classified as the lowest 25 percentile. That is what the system would describe as our worst students, or the 25% of our students who are categorized as being the worst students. But within that group, their improvement over where they were when they arrived at our school was so substantial that it was rated high across the state.
Frankly speaking, I was a little disappointed. I thought that we were even better than that. So I just know the capabilities of our children, and my expectations are high.
School administrators say there is a direct correlation between the school's African-centered curriculum and the children's academic improvements.
That's really the first stage of education. A lot of times we just want to give them the intellectual, but emotionally we have to make the student feel secure at home, that what he's learning has something to do, has a relevance to him and who and his collective environment. In this case, his African past, his African present. That is really the foundation for the school, is that the student becomes secure and grounded in who he is. Now, the question of standardized tests and how the students perform, yes, that is the stage that allows the student now to outperform what he would normally do without that grounding.
I think it's very important, because a lot of times in your mainstream schools, you have teachers that are totally insensitive to their population, and I think it's very imperative that students are exposed to their culture. So if you have a student in your class that has a Mexican heritage, they should be exposed to Spanish culture. If you have students that are of African descent, they need to be exposed to a culture that is African-centered.
The African-centered approach to education appears to be working for many of the children.
He's one of the first black men to hold such a high position in government. Who can remember which two presidents he served under?
After being introduced to the accomplishments and contributions of their ancestors, and through the encouragement of their current educators, these children who were once labeled learning disabled are expressing new and higher expectations for themselves.
You know what you want to be when you grow up?
Yes.
What do you want to be?
Three things.
Tell me about them.
I want to be a teacher, a doctor, and a lawyer.
A teacher, a doctor, and a lawyer.
What I want to do in life, as Mr. Gayeka would say, I want to sit my mama down so she won't have to work unless she wants to. And I want to be a successful, rich money maker playing football, and I want to be the best at what I do.
The phrase "sit your mama down" is a mantra expressed frequently at the Joseph Littles and Guzu Saba Charter School. It is an exhortation from Headmaster Amafika Gayuka, calling for the children to strive for academic success so that they may someday retire their mothers from years of hard work. Gayuka wants the children to understand that academics as a vehicle on the road to prosperity is just as viable as athletics. All the more reason, educators believe the children will continue to improve in standardized testing.
Sheets in the folders, bring them up to the desk, put them here.
In addition to core academic studies, students at Joseph Littles and Guzu Saba are learning about significant contributions blacks have made to America and to the world. The cultural enrichment studies go far beyond the usual black history lessons taught in mainstream public schools, which are typically given during the month of February, the month designated as Black History Month. The curriculum at Joseph Littles and Guzu Saba calls for year-long studies about black history, and not just lessons about Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X, or George Washington Carver. Children at Joseph Littles and Guzu Saba are also learning about Marcus Garvey, Toussaint Louverture, and the contributions of black Africans to the development of modern society.
I grew up in a totally integrated school system where I was taught nothing about black heritage and the black contribution to this country are to the world. So subconsciously, our education system has taught us that we've been grafted in, not that we were contributors long before there was a United States of America, long before there was a European society, that the contributions of the African continent were the bedrock of Western culture, period.
When we were in school, all we learned about was the slavery part of it, how black people came from slavery to civil rights and all of that stuff. They don't teach us, and it really, I think that it doesn't teach us about being proud. It actually teaches us to be ashamed of who we are, because they're like, oh my God, slavery. Who wants to talk about slavery?
You have to understand, black children need to understand that black people invented mathematics, that they're still trying to figure out how the pyramids are put together, and contrary to what we see on many documentaries, that the builders of these people were dark-skinned people. Cleopatra wasn't Liz Taylor. Those kind of things that he need to understand, not to be in competition with a racist position, but to build a good self-image, a good positive foundation to say, I can succeed because I have a history. My history is the foundation of this society.
I have to live with myself, and so I want to be fit for myself to know. I want to be able, as days go by, to always look myself straight in the eye. I don't want to stare when the setting sun and hate myself for the things I've done. I don't want to keep on a closet shelf a lot of secrets about myself and fool myself as I come and go into thinking that nobody else will know the kind of man I really am. I don't want to dress myself up in sham. I want to go out with my head erect. I want to deserve all men's respect. But here in the struggle for fame and wealth, I want to be able to like myself. I never can hide myself from me. I see what others may never see. I know what others may never know. I never can fool myself, and so whatever happens, I want to be self-respecting and conscience-free.
If you don't see it with your own eyes, you might not ever believe it. Elementary and middle school children exiting a school bus, totally unsupervised by an adult. Yet the children are orderly and very well behaved.
Gotta go. Come on, let's go, let's go. Come on. Hey, stand in line.
As the children walk single file into their school building to begin a day of classes, a couple of them take charge, and the other children respect their authority regardless of age. Male students instinctively open and hold the door for their female classmates. This isn't the result of some military-type indoctrination. School officials say it is the direct result of children being well-grounded in who they are culturally and then taking pride in their culture.
African-centric model is, you know, very different. It's very unique. And it has affected me in a lot of ways because I've now learned to get into my history of life. I know a lot about black history, and I'm very acquainted to it. You know, I like it very much, and it keeps me, you know, whole.
The Joseph Littles and Guzu Saba Charter School has a student population of about 200.
It was going this way towards the lake.
Towards Palm Beach Lake, Palm Beach Lake Boulevard.
Oh, so we go south.
South. Correct.
That makes for small class sizes with an average of about 15 students per teacher. With that sort of teacher-student ratio, children can get the extra attention they need to...
My daughter has really soared with just being able to interact in the way that she expresses. She's more outcoming, and the way that she expresses with just talking to another person as an adult, it's like, it's phenomenal. It's like, I can't believe that this is the same child that I had in a public school when she was in third grade.
Another component of the children's academic success is nutrition. The first order of every day at Joseph Little's in Guzu Saba, even before Umoja time, is breakfast in the school's cafeteria. Like in most schools, the cafeteria is also a place for socializing.
When I brought my children here, I became much, much more active as a parent. When my children were in public school, I attended the PTO meetings, and when they asked me to sell candy or bring home the books and sell this and sell that, I was there. But they really didn't try to encourage the parents to come out to the school and be a part of the children. Then when you do pop up, it's like they want to know if you have an appointment.
Angela Walker has four children attending Joseph Little's in Guzu Saba. Her volunteer work at the school and her involvement in her children's education were so impressive, she landed a permanent job at Joseph Little's in Guzu Saba as parent liaison. Parental involvement is a vital component to the success of Joseph Little's in Guzu Saba. So much so, the school requires parents and their children to enter into a contract.
We go over that contract, we read it, I explain it to them. When they come in, we go in with Mr. Gayuka and we have a meeting so that he can explain what he expects from the parents and from the child, make sure that they want to be here, make sure that by this being an African-centered school, make sure they want to be here.
There has to be a contract between the parent, the child, and the school. And everybody has to do their part. When that happens, you find marked success. Parents have to understand that they can come to this school any time of day. If they're willing to help out in a classroom or in a cafeteria, or if they just want to sit in on the class and watch their child perform or help their child, that's permissible, and it's recommended.
The hours of operation at Joseph Little's in Guzu Saba were established specifically to accommodate working parents who are not able to pick up their children at normal school dismissal time. This approach prevents youngsters from becoming so-called latchkey children, who are typically left unsupervised.
Application, the freeze was like, do your own thing, get to the point of integration, new ideas.
Joseph Little's in Guzu Saba regularly holds parent support organization meetings in which administrators encourage parents to participate. The school also sends parents to out-of-state workshops and conferences designed to help them understand the vision for the school and how they can effectively involve themselves in their children's education.
What Dr. Howard Fuller, who's leading the school choice movement in Milwaukee, has done, he has been able to assemble the whole scenario of what the choice movement is about, what the charter school movement is about, and put it all in perspective. And to his credit, he was able to do this in first-class facilities in Milwaukee, and our staff and our students from Joseph Little's and Guzu Saba Charter School was able to go there and interact in a very professional way, interact in a very cordial and very elegant way with other teachers, really seeing themselves on the cutting edge of a new movement.
Hot.
As parent liaison, it is Walker's job to make home visits and educate parents on the importance of taking an active role in their children's education. Walker is successful with some parents, but she admits for many, old habits are hard to break.
Some of the parents that we deal with, I think they're so used to and the cycle going, it's like a long cycle of parents not being involved, and they just follow along.
I choose not to be a common man. It's my right to be uncommon if I can. I seek opportunity, not security. I do not wish to be a kept citizen, humbled and dull, but having the state look after me. I won't calculate the risk, to dream, to build, to fail and succeed. I refuse to live by hand to mouth. I prefer the challenges of life, the guarantee of existence, the thrill of fulfillment, to the stale calm of utopia. I will never cower before any master, nor bend to any threat. It's my heritage to stand erect, proud and unafraid, to enjoy the benefits of what I created. and I face the world boldly and say, this I have done.
Children have a natural instinct to run. It is a big part of their playtime. These elementary school children at Joseph Little's and Guzusaba Charter School run aggressively during recess. It is their only opportunity to expel surplus energy built up during the school day. But a major concern for school administrators is the only place these children have to play is on this asphalt playground, the school's parking lot.
I look out my window every day and worry. I don't worry about much of anything, but that's one thing that I do worry about, that one of those children does not trip and fall and hurt himself or herself. But as it stands right now, we have no other place for those children to enjoy themselves.
Joseph Littles in Guzusaba is housed in this office building located on West Palm Beach's north side and just east of Interstate 95. This facility, retrofitted to accommodate classrooms, is far less than ideal, but it is considered a blessing when compared to where the school was forced to hold classes in the beginning.
We started out on a school bus. The physical plants was not ready when they got ready to start. So physically, the school, the children would be picked up on a bus, go to a public park, and have learning take place.
During the startup months, the children, teachers, administrators, and parents functioned in a nomadic environment, constantly on the move, temporarily holding class wherever and in whatever facility that would welcome them. Some of the locations included the Urban League of Palm Beach County, a community full-service center, the West Palm Beach Public Library, a church in West Palm Beach, the Riviera Beach Public Library, and a Riviera Beach park. The park proved to be one of the harshest conditions educators would have to endure.
The teachers got tired because in the afternoon, the teaching was no problem, but in the afternoon, being at the park every day wasn't the best thing. It was okay for children, but it wasn't okay for us, but we managed.
And really the essence of what the school is in the heart of the people who were trying to keep this thing going. So whether we met in the modules over at Redemptive Life, we met in the renovated law offices on Forest Hill, we even met in the over there at the Roosevelt Full Service Center. It didn't matter. The school still had an entity, and that entity really came out of the heart of the student, heart of the teachers. So we was able to maintain Joseph Little's and Guzusaba Charter School no matter what building we occupied, no matter where we were going. We were like nobodies, but we still had a home.
No other group showed more school spirit and tenacity than the parents.
Daughter has really soared with just being able to interact in the way that she expresses. She's more outcoming, and the way that she expresses with just talking to another person as an adult, it's like, it's phenomenal. It's like, I can't believe that this is the same child that I had in a public school when she was in third grade.
The parents of Joseph Littles in Guzusaba. After seeing their children labeled and classified as learning disabled, the parents had finally found someone who believed in their children and they weren't about to let go. Some saw learning by school bus and moving from place to place as a mere temporary inconvenience.
In a way, I knew that even though all through the tragedy and tough times that the school have went through, I knew sooner or later that it was going to progress, because the average parent like, okay, I can't deal with this because it's my kid's education. But I seen that it was not going to always be like that. That's for anything. As far as life in general, it might be hard time, but it's also going to be, you know, a reward at the end. So that's why I didn't bother to take my kids out.
The parents, that's what I keep saying, our parents were wonderful. They didn't complain. They knew what we were doing, and they were supportive of us. And the teachers were supportive. Of course, we grew tired sometimes and weary, but we hung in there.
Let's review quickly all the keywords that we identified in the book on yesterday. Give me some words that come to your mind when you think of that word.
In their current location, educators can at least offer the children of Joseph Littles and Yuzu Saba modern technology and academics that is much the same as enjoyed by students in traditional schools. But the charter school falls far short in other areas.
With respect, however, to boys in particular, but also girls increasingly, wanting to participate in extracurricular activities of all sorts, not just sports, but sports having a particular attraction, obviously. Yes, that is a downer, if you will. And it's certainly something that mitigates against the students maximizing their holistic development, because it is in fact beneficial to children to be able to engage in well-organized, constructive, and supervised recreational and sports activities. We'd also like to have an arts program where children, because many of our children are very artistic.
We real cool, not we left school, stupid, we learned late, we scratch faces. We sang fans, we thin June, we jazz June, and we die soon.
Even with a seemingly endless mound of paperwork reflected in his eyes, Headmaster Amafika Gayuka has never lost sight of the vision for the Joseph Littles and Yuzu Saba Charter School. Gayuka spends most of his time handling the business end of the school, which ranges from making sure the charter is renewed with the school district to fending off nuisance negative press. The most daunting task Gayuka faces daily is fighting for adequate school funding.
Absolutely. And that's an abomination, in fact, because charter schools are public schools. The students who attend our schools are public school students. There is absolutely no sane justification for why a child who is worth perhaps $17,000 per capita when he or she is enrolled in and attending a regular or traditional public school in Palm Beach County should be valued at only about $6,000 should that child's parent decide to enroll them in a charter school.
Unlike mainstream public schools, which have both an operating and capital budget, charter schools are forced to use their operating dollars for both capital and operating expenses. The school district doesn't share revenue generated from ad valorem taxes with charter schools.
The question I keep raising as a board member is, when are they going to see that we're doing a better job with children they say they cannot educate, and they're mainstreaming and they're performing and they're excelling? We're doing that on a shoestring budget. When is someone going to notice and give us the money we need?
To make matters worse, according to Gayuka, borrowing money from lending institutions has been next to impossible because of the way mid-level school district staff handled the renewal of the school's charter, which Gayuka says made the school unattractive to banks.
There's no question about it, but there are people within the staff at the school district of Palm Beach County who have never wanted to see this school in particular, succeed. I'm pleased to say, however, that attitude is not shared by the superintendent, who had to make the recommendation that our charter be renewed, and it's certainly not shared by the majority of members of the school board who had to vote in favor of our renewal.
Just as the school raised the bar and maintained high expectations for students, school officials have likewise raised the bar for themselves. They are determined to build a permanent school home that is state-of-the-art. Educators at the Joseph Littles and Yuzu Saba Charter School believe standardized test scores will continue to improve, and some believe the school will rise to a level in prestige in the future that will require a waiting list for admission.
Yes, Oh, yes, we do. And we also have in mind that our school will be duplicated, that this will not be the only Joseph Little Zinguzo Saba Charter School, that there will be several Joseph Little Zinguzo Saba Charter Schools.
I'm thinking beyond this particular school in this particular building. I would like to see Zinguzo Saba schools. I would like for the concept to become the model, you know, the model school, and see other, you know, schools throughout the country go to this particular concept. So I hope to see Zinguzo Sabas in Fort Lauderdale, you know, throughout Palm Beach County, in Tallahassee, in Chicago, Atlanta. I'd like to see them all over the country.
If we stay on course as to where we were last year, we should get the A. I really do feel that, and we can get that. Every year we get better and better. So I'm looking for the best. I aim for the highest, you know, and that's what we teach our children also. But I really do believe that. If not, I wouldn't be here.
Educators at Joseph Little's and Zinguzo Saba say they are determined to carry out those dreams. But for now, they must do whatever it takes to improve the school's current facility. Administrators say they also expect within the next 5 years, their students will be heavily recruited by the top high schools in Palm Beach County.
We're determined that our school and our students will emerge on a competitive basis with the Meyer Jewish Academy insofar as the desirability of the high schools in this county to have our students, our graduates of our eighth grade, attend their respective high schools because of what they will bring to those schools, especially with respect to their GPAs, their academic achievement, and of course their behavior and conduct or their good citizenship.
School officials say even after the day arrives when they can be more selective in choosing who will be admitted to Joseph Little's and Zinguzo Saba, children who are failing and who have been labeled learning disabled in mainstream public schools will always be welcomed here.
Yes, because it is that child's parents who has supported us all along. Yes, because we want to prove. Our theory is we believe every child can learn and that every child brings something to us. And so, therefore, we would never not take those children.
This is an excellent school. This is an excellent school because the ingredients of a good school are here. We have, first and foremost, a strong cadre of teachers, support staff, and administrators who love the children. They care about the children.
It's an official good school for kids who don't think that they're going to make it and blame it on their backgrounds, you know, because it's a school that teach you where you come from, that you can't use that as an excuse of how you end up in life or you end up successful or even not successful. You can't blame that on your background. You have to make a decision for yourself, and your decision is your decision. That's your destiny and destination.
In the next 5 years, the Joseph Little's and Zinguzo Saba Charter School will undoubtedly encounter new challenges as it seeks to expand, and some existing challenges may continue to menace the school. But in the final analysis, the lesson learned may very well be that with hard work, diehard tenacity, and faith, dreams really do come true. On behalf of the staff, faculty, administrators, and board members of the Joseph Little's and Zinguzo Saba Charter School, thank you for watching.
Oh!
archives just added a ton of new information this evening, and before the week is out, we'll be adding much, much more. This is the most awesome library inside the country. It's designed for you to actually use and to make transformations in your lives. There's tons of material for your children to get the truth about what really happened in ancient times, as well as in history. There's an abundance of information and documentation that you can actually use, fill in the blanks, get them notarized, and file them when you're doing your affidavits, and if you're filing lawsuits, whatever, all the tools that you need are there. So in order to access that, simply go to taharkaarchives.org. That's TaharkaArchives, taharkaarchives.org. Okay? Thanks.
Okay, Morris, we're back. Now, we dealt with all-black school, or what you call black, so-called black, inside the United States. And these types of schools is absolutely necessary. You have your own government, and now we have to make sure that we put the correct information in the brains of the children, because they are your future. So if you're going to do that, wouldn't it be a good idea to have a power base that you personally can draw from and to use as tools to get that job done? And I was so glad to run across the information and be able to present it here for you this evening, clearly showing that it is not only possible, but it actually have been done inside the United States. But we have to do it across the country. So there you have it. The plugs that we put up is called Sit Your Mama Down. You can go and see the actual videos in their entirety. For those of you who have my archives, we'll be adding that. But you can go right there to YouTube and see that in its entirety. It's seven different plugs, and you can see all seven of them. It's called Sit Your Mama Down. And so just type it into YouTube and go right there and check it out for yourself. Now, the second part of this evening, we're going to deal with the Nat Turner Rebellion, and because a lot of us don't know about that. And I thought it was very important that we get that information out. And we're going to deal with it from several different angles so you can see exactly what happened. Check it out. And so you will know what happened during that particular time period. There's been a whole lot of books written, a lot of people have said a lot of different things. But what we want to do is we want to get to the nutshell. Let's get it in the a nutshell and find out exactly can we specify it definitely to know exactly what happened. Okay, so y'all hold your hat for a minute and we get on down in here.
Live humble. Humble yourself to deal and wrong.
Born into slavery, a life of trouble and pain, many things would eventually lead to the tragic Nat Turner Slave Rebellion. In the summer of 1831, Nat Turner led a slave revolt that sent shockwaves throughout the South. This bloody uprising created a great conflict for plantation owners and slaves alike. This potentially national-scale conflict sent a message to slaves everywhere that revolting would lead to a tragic compromise. At the time of the Nat Turner Slave Revolt, slavery was at its height. The North had abolished many of its slaves, but the South was still the world's greatest cotton producer, and abolishing slavery would ruin this. One slave child said, "I saw my mammy beat until she was just a living piece of raw meat." John Brown, a violent American abolitionist, said, "Slavery is the sin of America." Nat Turner was born in Southampton County, Virginia, on October 2, 1800. He was born into slavery on the plantation of Benjamin Turner. Little is known about Nat's childhood. He attempted to escape this cruel life a few times, but was never successful. Nat Turner was extremely religious. He even baptized himself in a local creek. He would pray every night to God, and even believed he spoke to God himself. Nat Turner even believed he was the Black Moses, and he was ready to lead his people out of slavery.
Or take to an extreme the black slave interpretation of the Bible, and particularly the Old Testament. But if you look at the book of Exodus And, you know, I mean, the story of the Hebrews escaping from slavery and the freedom, which, not surprisingly, was a favorite among African American slaves.
He really saw himself as Jesus's ambassador, as the black Moses of the time.
31. There was an eclipse of the sun. Turner took this to be the sign that he had been promised, and confided his plan to the four men he trusted the most: Henry, Park, Nelson, and Sam. They decided to hold the insurrection on the 4th of July and began planning a strategy. However, they had to postpone action because Turner became ill.
On August 21st, 1831, Nat Turner started his rebellion. That evening, Turner and six other men met in the woods. At 2 a.m., they went to the home of Nat Turner's master. They killed the master, the wife, and the children in the house. As they left the house and got a mile down the road, they realized that they had left a baby in his cradle. Henry and Will went back and killed the baby, while Nat and Nelson went on to the next house.
The next house along the way was the Gills Reese house. Turner killed Reese, and he had a young slave woman named Cherry, who supposedly was Turner's wife.
From this point on, Turner would go around and kill the families and then recruit the slaves as a part of his rebellion. One example of this is the Catherine Whitehead House, also locally known as the Skykes House. There, he killed the family and buried them in the garden, and then recruited the slaves as a part of his rebellion.
One story of survival was the Nathaniel Francis house, where a slave concealed Mrs. Lavinia Francis in the attic. Thus, her life was spared.
On September 17, 1831, Governor John Boyd issued a proclamation for the reward and capture of Nat Turner.
This is the nightmare that they had even tried to rule out using the Fugitive Slave Act involved in the Constitution. Article 6 of the Constitution allows the U.S. government to use federal troops to put down slave rebellion. That tells you how much white Southerners feared slave revolt.
On October 31st, Ben Phipps, a local farmer, spotted and captured Nat Turner at gunpoint.
My name it is Paul Pilgrim, to Pain, and I am bound, traveling through this.
After, Turner was taken to the Southampton County Jail. There, he was appointed a lawyer, Thomas Ruffin Gray. Gray talked to Turner for days after he was captured. He then took it upon himself to write The Confessions of Nat Turner, a book read by most of the area at the time. In one instance, Gray asked Turner, "You know you're going to be hanged, right?" And Turner replied, "Was Christ not crucified?" This statement would be heard by most of the county and added to what the people thought of Turner.
In the next couple of months, every rebel except Nat Turner was quickly killed or captured. During September and into October, nearly 50 accused rebels stood trial in Southampton County. Almost all were executed by hanging.
On November 5th, 1831, Nat Turner was tried, convicted, and sentenced to death. The trial only took 48 hours. The man who said, "Was Christ not crucified?" was hanged on November 11th. In Jerusalem, Virginia. Now known as Cortland, Virginia, his body was then flayed, beheaded, and quartered.
In the bloody aftermath, close to 200 blacks, many of whom had nothing to do with the rebellion, were beaten, tortured, and murdered by angry white mobs. In addition, repressive policies were enacted for not only the enslaved blacks, but also many of the freedmen. No other slave uprising inflicted as severe a blow to the community of slave owners in the United States. Nat is and will forever be regarded as a hero by many African Americans.
Nat Turner finally became well known in present-day life in the 1940s when historian Herbert Apthorpe
published the first serious scholarly work on instances of slavery resistance in the antebellum South.
Oh, I salute him, as you all know. It's where the Jim Malone Tulsi's on the go. Tulsi's all right when the fingers ring. And it's just a song.
1968, William Strayton wrote a controversial book about Nat Turner, which won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. This book was very controversial because many of the facts mentioned were actually false. Nat Turner was introduced once again into present-day life in the 1960s during the Civil Rights Movement. Nat was an inspiration for the leaders and for the followers of the movement. Malcolm X quoted Nat in many of his speeches and actions, using violence instead of nonviolent protest as Nat did in his rebellion.
North America, but there were no successful slave rebellions in North or South America. Only in the Caribbean with the Haitian Rebellion do you see a successful slave rebellion.
Swing low.
In conclusion, Nat Turner created a huge conflict in which he ended up killing over 55 white men, women, and children. He recruited over 40 slaves as a part of his rebellion. With such a huge conflict, a compromise had to be met, but none was produced. The eventual compromise of the battle he was fighting would be the end of the Civil War. Nat Turner set the stage for all men to stand up for what they believed in, even if it was extreme.
Swing down, Jerry, won't you let me ride? Oh,
swing down, Jerry, stop and let me ride. Oh, rock me, Lord, come and eat.
I got a home.
In the words of Frederick Douglass,
the thing worse than rebellion is the thing that causes rebellion.
There is a sense of a providential journey in the African-American experience from the beginning of the cotton gin as a method of expanding slavery and creating havoc in black life through the separation of families, through this incessant labor, which seems to be able to go on in perpetuity. For African Americans, it represents a period when their idea of providence is that this is not pleasing in the sight of God.
Though black slaves made up only a small fraction of American Christians in the early 19th century, many who converted seized eagerly on the idea of divine retribution. One was a slave preacher named Nat Turner. Turner's actions in the summer of 1831 would force America to face its deepest fears and help a mounting abolitionist movement gain the attention of the nation.
While laboring in the field, I discovered drops of blood on the corn, as though it were dew from heaven. And as the blood of Christ had been shed on this earth, and had ascended to heaven for the salvation of sinners, it was plain to me that the Savior was about to lay down the yoke he had borne for the sins of men, and the great day of judgment was at hand. Nat Turner.
God in the Old Testament often worked through acts of violence and often protected the Israelites through acts of violence, and it was in that tradition that Nat Turner situated himself. He was an avenging Messiah who had come to save his people from the sinfulness of the slaveholding South.
Nat Turner was born in the year 1800, the week before Gabriel was hanged. In 1825, Turner voluntarily returned to bondage After successfully making his escape, the spirit had appeared to him, he said, and told him to return to his earthly master. But in 1828, the spirit appeared to him again.
I heard a loud noise in the heavens, and the spirit instantly appeared to me and said, the serpent was loosened, and Christ had laid down the yoke he had borne for the sins of men, and that I should take it on and fight against the serpent. For the time was fast approaching when the first should be last and the last should be first. And immediately, the seal was removed from my lips, and I communicated the great work laid out for me to do. Nat Turner.
Nat Turner confided his intention, he later explained, to four men in whom he had the greatest confidence. It was agreed that they would prepare a dinner, arm themselves, and then begin God's work.
The issue here is God made us to be free. God is empowering us to claim this freedom which God has promised to us. And so what we see is that with Nat Turner, the key concept is deliverance.
The work of death began on August 21st, 1831, and lasted for 36 hours. As more than 40 slaves joined Turner and his men in open rebellion. In the end, at least 55 white people were dead. An abolitionist newspaper in Boston, The Liberator, reported that whole families had been cut off. Not a mother, not a daughter, not a babe left. Putnam Moore, the young boy who legally owned Nat Turner, was murdered in the bed where he lay sleeping, outside Jerusalem, Virginia.
It's horrifying. There were young children who were killed. But you can feel the rage and you can feel the anger and you can wonder whether slavery ever would have ended without that sort of rage.
Nat Turner was hanged and then skinned in 1831. And for the first time, politicians in Virginia seriously considered a plan for abolishing slavery, but couldn't bring themselves to do it. Slavery was the soul of American progress. Without it, many argued, there would be no future. But to the growing abolitionist movement, Turner's rebellion was the beginning of the end.
What we have so long predicted has commenced. The first drops of blood, which are but a prelude, have fallen. The first flash of lightning has been felt. The first wailings of a bereavement, which is to cloak the earth, have broken upon our ears. The Liberator, September 3rd, 1831.
Okay, Moses, we're back. Now, I wanted to play that clip there because it is very important for us to understand everything that has transpired in the past that we've been on this continent. I do the best I can to bring up certain information for you to examine so that we will have all the facts. One thing I know for a fact is just like the young lady said, that after the Nat Turner Rebellion, Europeans decided to take a serious look at abolishing slavery, but they couldn't bring themselves to do it. Okay, Now I want to talk to you about hunting, fishing, and trapping. And it's very, very important that you learn how to hunt and learn how to fish and learn how to trap so that you can provide food for your family when you're in the woods. When you're practicing, instead of sitting there looking at the TV, go to the gun range and practice with your 30-06 so that you will never miss a target when you're shooting at a deer and providing food for your family. We are facing a collapse of the dollar, and it behooves us to know how to have certain types of skills. Now, you eliminate any fear that you would have when you replace that fear with special skills. And we're going to go down on into the rest of this thing, and we're going to come to you with Brother Barashango as he gets down into it. So y'all hold your hat.
When we are taught a doctrine that does not motivate us to improve our quality of life, then we must re-examine that doctrine. Nat Turner was one who lived in a setting that is very similar to ours. The setting we live in is more mental. The setting he lived in was more physical, although there is physical deprivation as we're being shot down in the street by brutal police and other mysterious deaths of black people going across the country. But in those days, it was blatant. No one tried to hide it. Kill a black man, to kill a black woman, to kill a black baby was no big deal if the master decided that's what he wanted to do with his property. Judge Taney, a Supreme Court justice of the United States of America, of the what? Not of Russia, not of Yugoslavia, not of Poland, but of the United States of America, said that black people had no right that a white man must acknowledge. That is what they said in this country, and that was upheld by the Supreme Court of the United States. That shouldn't come as a surprise to us. I once heard a white boy say, I think it was David Duke, one of the Ku Klux Klansmen, whenever they're speaking, I stop and listen. Very careful. I want to know what my enemy is doing. Understand? Don't get angry because I say enemy now. I would be a fool to stand up here and say we don't have any enemy, or that our enemy is ourselves alone. I wouldn't do that. That's not facing reality. That's like the ostrich burning his head in the sand with his behind out to the world. And he said something that was so clear. He said, I don't know why you're so upset with us. The founding fathers of this country were racist, were slaveholders, were segregationists. This country was not set up with the objective of black people being anything else but servants. So this was an idea that was forced upon them later. But it was never included in the Constitution of the United States that you should be that. They had to have an amendment to the Constitution, which still isn't clear. Still isn't clear. Still doesn't make you a citizen of this country. The point that I'm seeking to draw here is this, that Nat Turner understood this. And he looked around him and he said, I don't like the situation that I'm in. But that's nothing strange. Most slaves don't like the situation that they're in. But you have to get beyond the point of not liking it. You have to move to the next level, which is what? Doing something about it. This is part of the gospel that Nat Turner taught. Are you with me? I want to study some tonight. I want to do some teaching. I know y'all like a lot of preaching. I'm going to do some preaching. I'm going to do some teaching, too. And I'm going into the book, God, the Bible, and the Black Man's Destiny. which I certainly appreciate you buying, which is on sale here tonight. And I'm quoting, as I have it set down on page 155 from one of my favorite writers, which is Lerone Bennett. And he says that the missionary version of Christianity, which was drilled into the minds of the slaves, it was what? Drilled. And you wonder why. Well, you say, but that happened way back then. No, brother and sister, it still happened to you. You wonder why you are schizophrenic. You wonder why you have problems working with your brothers and sisters. You wonder why you have contradictions in you. And every great leader we have had has had some contradictions, and you want to put them down on that basis, but you can't do that. You are negating the realities of the impact of slavery on all of us. I like the way the Bible puts it. All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. We are all slaves. I ain't no slave, shop. I can go anywhere I want to, walk anywhere I want to. You do not control those things which your life is dependent upon for its very sustenance. If white folks decide tomorrow to cut off everything, you have but two alternatives. Let it go at that, lay down and die, or go off and fight. There are no others to that. So you have that no control of your, well, if a black man get in there, it won't be just bad. At least you have something to appeal to in here. You can keep working on that, and white folks, there is nothing for you to appeal to. Your nature is, I'm not saying that to be a racist, that's true. I mean, after thousands of years of history, you should be able to see that there are two distinct kinds of beings you're dealing with. That goes deeper than the color of the skin. It's deeper than the color of skin. That's right, it is. White folks are white because of a reason. They got out of harmony with nature. Well, no white folks on earth for millions of years. You ask white scholars behind closed doors, they'll tell you. They don't know how they got here. So they say, I came out the cave. That's all they know. They don't know anything else. Let me get back to this. The missionary version of Christianity and got you thinking you came out the cave too. That you, what's that cartoon they have on television? You think you into that, see? The missionary version of Christianity, which was drilled into the minds of the slaves, repelled that. In the Old Testament, in the blood and doom passages, he found a corroboration of his manhood. You see, they never wanted you to read the Bible. Let me get something straight with you here. You say the white man gave you the Bible. He did not. He never wanted you to read the Bible. He never wanted you to read anything because he knew it was dangerous for you to read anything. Nat Turner, when he was a boy, would get on his knees and plead with his master, who he was supposed to have a good master, a kind master, would get on his knees and say, please, master, teach me how to read. He said, ain't no nigger supposed to know how to read. It's dangerous. But nigga, to know how to read, your mind gets troubled when you read. And you get the disease. What disease was he talking about? In their medical books in that day, they had a disease called drapetomania. What was drapetomania? The fact that slaves would become dissatisfied and want to escape from their master. And they say, if you niggers read, you're going to get drapetomania, and you don't want that. That'll hurt you, boy. Not say, but master, I don't want to learn to read nothing else but the Bible, the Word of God, because I want to take it to my brothers and sisters out in the slave cabin who need the light of Christ so they can live right and obey their master. Yeah, that might not be a bad idea. Nat knew what he was doing. He taught him to read the Bible. This was a great mistake. The very man who taught him to read the Bible woke up on August the 21st around about midnight, and that axe was coming down on his head. And Nat had gotten that from reading the Bible. He got it from reading the Bible. If you read it right. And I don't know how y'all read the Old Testament and come out telling me to turn the other cheek. There are more bloody battles on there than you find in any movie or television show. They put their brothers in there, put 007 to shame. They was taking care of Gideon, and Joshua was taking care of business. They didn't play, but I'm not going to get in that subject right now. He said, but he saw in those texts a corroboration of his own manhood. He had come into a world of slaves. So violent was the world that he came into that his mother, out of love for him, this may be difficult for you to comprehend, in 1983, but had you been living in 1800,
okay, brother Barashango here.
Gabriel Prosser died and gave his life for this struggle, and saw the condition of black people at that time. His mother said, "Before I bring another slave in this world, I'll kill him." They had to tie her up to keep her from killing that baby. But she didn't want, wasn't she didn't love her child? She didn't want to bring another slave in the world. Those are the conditions that he was born on October the 2nd, 1800, 183 years ago. This black baby came into the world, but they knew not what was coming. Uneventful, born in the slave cabin, except for the fact that his mother tried to take his life, but that wasn't unusual. Many African women sought to take the lives of their babies rather than bring them into slavery. But when she looked on his body, she observed certain marks. Something told her, said, "This is a special child." His daddy looked at him and said, "This is a special child." As he grew up in the neighborhood around him, they said, the white folks would come and look at him and say, "He's too smart. Mm-mm. He's supposed to be that smart. He'll never make a good slave. He's too smart." Even as a child, Nat was telling the future, telling things that had happened before he came here, so that the community began to call him a prophet. And that's where we get our subject, the gospel, according to old Nat, the prophet. That's what they called him back then. Now, when the community get together and call you a prophet, you're a prophet. If they respect you in that direction and look to you in that way because of his moral character, he neither drank nor smoked, nor he didn't even take money. He had a completely ascetic life, and all he did when he wasn't at the plow was read the Bible, pray, and get instructions from his God so that he could become a liberator for his people. He had a moral life, a clean life. You understand what I'm saying to you? Every leader that has come to us has had to deal with our what? Moral. But the master has made you so immoral through his dirt and his filth. And he looked in there and saw his manhood. Because a man who is in bondage to another man cannot be a man as long as he accepts that bondage. He only becomes a man when he takes his own destiny into his hands and confronts his master and says, "I am a free man whether I live or die." Ain't that what Patrick Henry said? Give me liberty or give me death. You thought that was wonderful, didn't you? That he said that to the British. And you just jump up and down when you hear that. But what happened when Nat Turner said he looked in the Old Testament and saw his manhood? Because it said he must confront his slave master. Let's move on now. And in the New Testament, he found a despised man, a racial outcast, a poor man, a revolutionary who cursed fig trees and violently drove money changers from profane temples. Who was that man that he saw in the New Testament? erasing the outcast man. Why could Nat Turner identify with that man? Because he understood that that man, 2,000 years earlier, was a black man who was fighting for his liberation from a white man, the Roman power structure. And Nat saw himself in that year, 1828, also fighting the Romans again here in the United States of America, a black man fighting for his freedom against white men. I know you may think that this is violent, but you must study this. I'm not telling you to get up and walk out here and start smacking white folks upside the head. Strategically, that wouldn't be good to do. Morally, it would be correct. But I don't want to see you going to jail on no humble. I'd like to see us have a scientifically well-planned, protracted struggle. And I hope it's not protracted too much longer. So this is not what we're saying. We're stating to you that it is morally correct to defy your oppressor. It is immoral not to do so. That is what caused Jesus his life, but that's another subject. He wasn't hung on no cross for your sins, for mine either. He was hung on the cross because he rebelled, had the nerve and the audacity to proclaim himself king of his people. That meant he brought himself into political, not only religious, political opposition to the Roman Empire and the handkerchief head preachers of his day. You got to understand the real Jesus. I'm going to come back one day, preach the sermon with the real Jesus. Please stand up. Are you all right? Are you with me? When Nat, I'm talking about whose gospel now? The gospel according to old Nat the prophet. This is what he saw as a theologian of the gospel of black liberation. He said he saw a revolutionary in Jesus. What is a revolutionary? A revolutionary is one, as Brother Malcolm taught us, who seeks change. One who does not accept conditions as they are, but sets about to correct those conditions. That's what a religion is supposed to do for you. Whether you're Muslim, Christian, Buddhist, Israelite, no matter. Akan, Yoruba, y'all got to stop fighting over all them things. Muslims not talking to Christians, and Christians not talking to Israelites. And you don't pray this way and don't do that way, brothers and sisters. The white man only sees one thing when he sees Africans. Something he can exploit, and if not, destroy. That's all he sees. He doesn't see those differences. Therefore, those differences must not exist among us. Please pray to Allah and remember Ishaqa Musa as you do. And when I am in your temple, I will take my salat too. Please pray to Jesus and remember Ishaqa Musa when you do. When I am in the church, I will pray to him too. Please honor the prophet Moses. When I am in the synagogue of the black people, I will too. Please honor Shango. That's where I pull my energy from. That thunder and lightning and power of Shango. It's all one, brothers and sisters. And it seems that wherever I go, I have to stop and deal with that, because that is a concept that the Creator is trying to get through to you now. What speaker to black people stands before you today that does not bring that home to you? Because it is so important. Before you were brought here as a slave, you knew nothing about all these differences. You created every religion that is worthy of being called one, and you existed with each other in the frame of reference of those religions. There were battles from time to time, yet we found ways to work things out. We must do that now. He saw a revolutionary who cursed fig trees and violently drove money changers from the profane temple. I like Nat's description of Jesus. Because the one they usually portray to us is the blonde-haired, blue-haired boy with his wrist hanging down, holding a lamb. That's so sweet. That when he touches so delicately when he steps out. That wasn't Jesus. That kind of man couldn't have drove money changers out of the temple. You know what money changers are like? That's like going down on Wall Street and driving in the middle of the trading session and driving folks out of there. You got to understand the reality. And that is what the gospel, according to old Nat the prophet, deals with, reality. Consumed by the images and visions of the Old and New Testament, Nat Turner turned the book. He did what? Turned the book against the people who had given it to him. The more Nat read the Bible, the more he became convinced that he was destined to lead his people out of slavery. That is the gospel, according to old Nat the prophet. But you know, there were other black theologians there in those days, around that era. And I want to talk about agreement with old Nat the prophet. They worked together. I'm going to go back to the Bible text now. Are you all right? You still with me? I'm going to go back to the Bible text, the first one now, and I'm going to take it apart the way we do in the seminary. It's what they call an exegesis. That just means breaking it down. It says, for if a man think himself to be something, when he is nothing, he deceiveth himself. Now, without somebody to give some clarity on that, you would become confused. What does it mean for a man to think that he is something when he is nothing? He deceiveth himself. This is the principle number one I want to deal with here of that text. And that principle is this, that an oppressed man is nothing if he is not a revolutionary. An oppressed man is nothing if he is not a revolutionary. Let's go now to another great theologian of that time. And his name is the Right Reverend. Anybody know where I'm going? Got any idea where I'm going? The Right Reverend David Walker. And he says, in David Walker's appeals, I pray. And Nat was in total agreement. What Walker wrote, Nat lived and carried out in his life. In Boston, he published his appeals. David Walker did in the year 1829. In the year 1828, Nat was coming to receive and understand that he had a special mission that he had to fulfill to the race. You see how all those things were operating together there. When the Spirit moves, the Spirit moves. And if you be in tune with the Spirit, be in tune with the plan, even if you don't know what it is, get in tune with it. You'll know what to do. And he said, now here's Nat down there in Southampton County, Virginia. And here's David Walker up in Boston, Massachusetts. I pray that the Lord may undeceive, may do what? My ignorant brethren. And permit them to throw away pretensions and seek after the substance of learning. That text for a man to say he is something when he is nothing, he deceiveth himself. What David Walker says to us here is he was talking to some Negroes of his day who thought because they had been allowed to study under the white man in the North and gotten a few degrees, or at least rubbed shoulders with some, that they were wiser than the slave in the field, that they had become free, that they had become something. But he strove to teach them that you are nothing, that you not only deceive yourself, you're pretending to be a man if you do not seek the real substance of learning. What is the real substance of learning? What is the object of anything that one learns any discipline or field you go into, what is the object of going into that study? Will someone tell me, please? Huh? To progress, to move forward, to become functional, to become better and more functional at what you do. The word education comes from the Latin word educa, which means to bring out the best in a person. And if what you learn and what you are taught does not bring out the best in you, then you are not educated, no matter how many degrees you may have. If you, therefore, do not have your own land, if you are not independent as a people, you have therefore not been educated, but you have been miseducated. For you have not learned to take what you know and make it functional to achieve the total objective of the black man at this stage of history, which is what? Land and self-determination. So all of us in here are ignorant. Dr. Reverend Dr. Ishaka Musa included. Because we have not achieved our aim at this time. So we must take that under consideration. He goes on to say here, an educated man is a revolutionary man. What? Particularly in a situation of oppression. Do you suppose that one man of good sense and learning would submit himself, his father, mother, wife, and children to be slaves to a wretched man like himself? Said, now, you have to be, you don't have good sense to do this. If you're allowing someone to continue to oppress you, whether that oppression be covert or overt, you therefore haven't got good sense. You're sick in the head. The Bible says the whole head is sick. We got to be ill to be in this condition. And you know, I get this feeling that we're just right, like there's a veil between, we're just right there at it. I get this feeling that it's not far away, but it seems to be so distant because we can't get in tune with ourselves, each other, and the plan. Because each man's ego wants to think his piece of the plan is the total plan. It don't work like that. You are not the creator. You don't know the end from the beginning. Your organization, what you're doing, only knows a part of it, but it's an important part. Everybody gets a piece of it. And you must come to that light. But I do sense that we're not far away from it. I remember as I go back in the Bible, I mean, I get all my material that the Creator gave me tonight, but I'm going to cover, and when I sense that you can't take no more, I'm going to stop. I know how to feel. I don't want you to be tortured just sitting here listening. I may not follow the course of action that I've planned, but I'm going to move with the Spirit. I remember when the children of Israel, it's a story now, there's a lot of debate on that historically, and I'm not going into that. But the principle is what I'm dealing with. Was 11 days journey. How many days? From the promised land that they were going after. And they were going after some land. They weren't going to heaven. They was on their way to get some what? They left one piece of land going after some more. Because you can't be yourself. You can't serve your God. Unless you have your own what? Got to have it. So they're going to the land. They're 11 days journey away from the land. The only thing kept them from getting in the land was doubt and fear. The very people that they were going to take the land from, which was incorrect, and I'm using the illustration now, one group of black people taking land from another group. We're trying to get a principle here. We're more afraid of them, thinking they were more in number than they were afraid of going in the land. But because they would not move, check this out, and take that straightforward fight into the land, what would have been 11 days became 40 years. You know why that was done? So that all the doubters could die out. When the doubters died out, then Joshua and Caleb, if you remember the story, went in and took the land and put it all to the sword. They didn't just the walls of Jericho fell down. They did what? They fought the battle of Jericho. It was a bloody battle. It was a battle of genocide. They wiped out the inhabitants of the land. I didn't say I approved of it. I just say the revolutions tend to be bloody. Now, I'm not to say that we should be preoccupied with blood. You do what you have to do when you have to do it. And you keep a peaceful state of mind. There was no more peaceful man than Nat Turner. When the Creator showed Nat Turner that he would have to rise up, he showed him spirit in the sky fighting and struggling and blood flowing. He said, "Oh, Lord, I don't want to part of that." So, Nat, how do you get up from... What must be done, Nat. I send you forth to do. He was a peaceful man who hated violence, but he was not the perpetrator of violence. He was the victim of it. And the only way that the violence could be corrected was to land a blow of violence. It was a fight fire with fire situation. So in those 48 hours, over 60 white folks, babies included. I know you don't like this part. Think about it. When they came out of the first house, the Travis house, I'm not going to give you all the details of the story. You're going to do some reading on your own. I'm sure you've done it already. When they came out of the house, there was still an infant left. Nat said, "Do what?" Why? Because nits make life. One day that child would grow up and oppress his child. That's the reality you had to face. Now, I'm not telling you to go kill no... Please understand me. I'm not telling you to go kill nobody's baby. Now, I'm not telling you to do any of those things. When the time is given and the Lord moves, what has to be done will be done. I only say this, that you must not let anyone or anything stand between you and your freedom. When you see it coming, nothing. Don't you go out there tomorrow killing up a whole bunch of white folks acting crazy. We need you here now. Time is not yet. It may not be too long, though. God moves in mysterious ways. There's wonders to perform. That's not violence. That's a reality. When I look at my babies, I look at their babies, if something got the cold, it's not going to be mine. I'm not going to have mine down at the pig trough eating and fighting with the dogs for pig food no more. Uh-uh. Not as pretty as my children are. No more than my grandchildren. No more days like that. Mm-mm. Somebody got to go. It won't be me, as Dr. Ben said, when he go over that mountaintop, somebody going with me. I'm going into, so we established the first principle here that an oppressed man is nothing. He doesn't become a revolutionary. Now, we know how that applied to Nat today. We know that that was carried out in a raw fashion. There was no other way to carry it out. You couldn't intellectualize that. You had an oppressor right there whipping you every day, wouldn't allow you to be a man or to be a woman. Take your woman, take your sister, take your mother anytime he wanted, take your behind anytime he wanted to. They were faced with a situation. There was no intellectualizing there. You just went straight forward. Took care of business. That's what we found. Same thing George Washington was faced with. They didn't intellectualize with the British. They did what? They shot at them. And when Peter Salem, at the Battle of Bunker Hill, bust the cap in Major Pitcairn, white folks stood up and rejoiced. The only time they stood up and rejoiced when a black man shot a white man. He wasn't called a terrorist. He wasn't called a criminal. Why wasn't he? Because he was fighting for the white man's freedom from a white man. He only becomes a terrorist. He only becomes bloody. He only becomes a criminal when he fights for his own freedom and sheds blood for his own freedom. Somebody else's blood, his enemy's blood. That is. We go now to the next verse. But let every man prove his own work, and then shall he have rejoicing in himself alone and not in another. What does that mean? That brings to me a second principle of the gospel according to old Nat the Prophet. And that second principle is this: the responsibility of freeing the oppressed is on the who? The oppressed. No one liberates the oppressed. They liberate themselves. Well, why this man keep talking about all this oppression? I understand back in that Turner's day, back in slavery times. Why is he talking about that in 1983? Ain't nobody oppressed. Are you living the life you really want to live? Do you enjoy this life the way it is? Do you like the idea that a Wild West cowboy that ain't got good sense decide whether you get your foreign aid check or not? Do you like living like that? Do you like everything that black folks in the civil rights era fought for, died for, is being slowly taken away from? Do you enjoy that? Do you enjoy being the highest among the unemployed in the country? Do you enjoy that? Do you enjoy your life being so precariously perched upon uncertainty so that you're not even sure of the air you breathe and the water you drink? Whether the neighborhood you live in today will be there a year from now. You're not even sure of that. Why aren't you sure of it? Because, as according to the New African Creed, it says we lack the power to control our own lives. I don't like that. Call me wild, call me crazy, call me whatever you want to, but I am power hungry. I don't want power over nobody else. I want power over me. But I know I cannot have power over Ishaka Musa unless I collectively have power with my brothers and sisters over the area that we live in, over that which we inhabit in the world. Man, don't you know the Lord is tired of calling you to this? Been calling you so long. Gave up so many for you. I don't know how much longer he's going to wait. But there's a train coming. Get on board, brothers and sisters. Get on board. I'm going now to another black theologian. I'm not going to be too much longer. But I'm going now to Reverend Henry Highland Garnett, another preacher who preached the gospel according to old Nat the Prophet. Did you know we had that many theologians? We have a lot more than that. And in the year 1843, this is what Reverend Henry Highland Garnett said. This is a preacher man now. I want you to understand this. Some preachers today walk around talking this talk. I want you to know what real preachers had to say. When we get down to this situation that the oppressed have the responsibility of liberating themselves. Brethren, the time has come when you must act for yourselves. You must do what? Act. Get into motion. We can walk around and talk as much as we want to about what's wrong, what Reagan's doing. That shouldn't even bother you at all. You must understand that your existence does not depend on him, on John Wayne reincarnated, but it rests in your hands. And if you truly, truly believe in God, that's my challenge to all black people who say they believe in God. If you truly believe, then you would know that there is no power on earth greater than the Creator. Therefore, you would fear no one. And you would get up and do what you have to do. And you know what it is you have to do. We don't know. We don't have a lot of leadership now. We're confused. All you have to do is look back at what you've been taught. Examine what you've been taught. Look at the program of the Honorable Marcus Garvey. Look at the program of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. Look at the programs that have been laid. You had more programs than anybody else in the world. You don't need anything new. You just need to carry those things out. You don't need to wait until the whole race gets together before you move. You're going to sit up in front of the television and smoke dope and say, well, when we get it together, I'm going to join the revolution. Nat Turner started out with four men. Four. And you know, Nat planned to take the whole state of Virginia. You know that? Nat wasn't playing. He was going to take the county. Truly believe in God. That's my challenge to all black people who say they believe in God. If you truly believe, then you would know that there is no power on earth greater than the Creator. Therefore, you would fear no one. And you would get up and do what you have to do. And you know what it is you have to do. We don't know. We don't have a lot of leadership now. We're confused. All you have to do is look back at what you've been taught. Examine what you've been taught. Look at the program of the Honorable Marcus Garvey. Look at the program of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. Look at the programs that have been laid. You had more programs than anybody else in the world. You don't need anything new. You just need to carry those things out. You don't need to wait until the whole race gets together before you move. You're going to sit up in front of the television and smoke dope and say, well, when we get it together, I'm going to join the revolution. Nat Turner started out with four men. Four. And you know, Nat planned to take the whole state of Virginia. You know that? Nat wasn't playing. He was going to take the county seat. Then he was going to take the county. Then he was going to move for the state. And if he got trapped up, he was going to fight a guerrilla warfare from the Dismal Swamp. Once he got up in there, they'd have never been able to get him. That's the plan he had in mind. And I'm going to tell you what happened. He could have carried that plan out. I'm going to tell you in a little bit as we move down. But look at this. He didn't wait until all the slaves agreed with him. You know, them niggas have gone on back. Ain't no sense in us messing with him no more. We taught them in the 60s and 70s. Now they out there, Jared Carolyn, and just going it. But they're your brothers and sisters. What happened to you? When the Jew boy took the camera away, you stopped. Suddenly the struggle isn't popular anymore because you're not getting applauded. Because everybody's not wearing a push. But everybody's not wearing a dash chicken. And a boo-boo, you going to stop. And sit down. Do nothing. And then what you do is destroy yourself. You get caught up in your own sicknesses then. You get caught up in your own sicknesses and start squabbling with each other. I'm talking right now, I'm talking to all black people. Right now, I'm talking to the black nationalists, of which I am one. I am a black nationalist revolutionary. I am a separatist. I am that now. I will probably always be that. If you see me change, send me on to glory. Because I see no other logical way to be. That's the only way to make sense to me. And it's not about racism or anything like that. I'm not concerned about anybody else. I'm concerned about black people. Now, I have to deal with other people. I have to observe them because they're here, unfortunately. You got to do business with them. You got to do all that. But I don't want to play with them. I don't want to play with me. I'm not trying to save America. I'm trying to save the world, yeah, so it can get back to the original people that it belonged to.
because the Bible says when the righteous are in authority, the people rejoice. People not rejoicing, righteous not in authority. Let me get on back to here now. I'm getting my inspiration from these brothers now. Their voices are speaking from the ethers to us tonight. You must act for yourself. And even though the people think we're crazy and locked in a time vacuum, you old niggas with that 60s stuff, y'all and got wasted in a time vacuum. I got black folks who come to me and say, I used to be black. And I'm pretty diplomatic till you reach that point with me. And something goes ding in my head and I go off. What? And they think we're crazy. And crazy kept, we act crazy. We get eccentric. Wasted in our own knowledge. You got so much, the nationalists is actually the smartest people in our race. You know that? But you got so much of knowledge, it's like a stick of dynamite. If you don't handle it right, it'll blow you up. And it'll blow you up. You want everybody to have the same diet you do. You want everybody to wear the same thing you do. You want everybody to say the same thing you say, and if they don't, you get mad with them and turn on them. You can't do that. You're going to have to go do your job now. You should never have got this knowledge if you wasn't going to use it. And if you don't go do your job, the Lord knows how to make you do it. I know. He with me for many a year. I know what he'll do. I'm trying to save you that whooping. And we have to be diplomatic. You can't jump up in their face no more now, or they'll turn you off. So you have to be patient and striving. But you have to bring these people in. There's black folks out there that's got some money. This movement needs money. You don't run no revolution with no ducats. Not in 1983. You know you have to have ducats. So you have to go to them. And you can't just step in there first and say, look, you ought to be giving them. People don't do what they ought to do. You have to give them a logical, concrete reason for doing it. So that's where you have to sharpen yourself. I'm talking to everybody in here. But most people in here are nationalists. Are in the culture. And you have a duty as an ambassador for the new world. And if you don't carry out that duty, you will stand before the judgment bar of God. And your life will be required of you. All right, let me move on. Have mercy, Lord. Look around you and behold the bosoms of your loving wives, heaving with untold agony. Hear the cries of your poor children. Remember the stripes that your fathers bore. Black women are in a state of confusion today. They don't know whether they want to go with Gloria Steinem or what they want to do. They don't know whether they want... Now, I agree with rights. Women's rights to the extent that if a woman does a job I do, she should get paid for that job the same way I do, if she's going to do that job. But I want you to hear this, black man. The world will never respect you as a man if you do not make the world respect your woman. And you must, in one way you get the world to respect your woman is not smacking your woman upside the head, not lording over her, but using your mind. You should control the economy in your community. What did I say? And the nationalists of all people, most of us can't get no jobs anyway. Some of us got an FBI record, all kind of stuff. If we can spend $160 billion in 1 year, which we did last year, why are you sitting around worried about how you're going to make ends meet and waiting for the next foreign aid check to come? Or to get what you can get. They owe it to you. I don't talk about welfare, foreign aid, because I am not a citizen of this country. I'm just getting some foreign aid, same way Israel getting some, Poland getting some. Just they only send us a few hundred dollars, you know. Get what you can. But it ain't welfare. Welfare is for citizens. Foreign aid. Foreign aid, they come day after tomorrow. You know what it comes to. Banks be crowded. But while you're doing that, you must be making plans, excuse me, collectively, to get out of that syndrome. As Nat met with four men and then three others joining me at seven men, you, if you can't work with a bunch of people, get two or three brothers and sisters you can work with. But build some kind of economic enterprise that feeds the needs of black people and becomes self-sufficient. There's no other way to do this. Why are our institutions closing down? Because we do not have the funds to keep them. Is Harvard closing down? Of course not. Why isn't Harvard closing down? Because AT&T and Xerox and IBM and all those companies keep Harvard alive. The only way your institutions will survive is that you economically keep them alive. So, brothers and sisters, it is very revolutionary. I say what? To study the principles of business, of commerce, of enterprise, and to put them into practice. As Juan Limu, Dr. Chancellor Williams, says in the book, The Destruction of Black Civilization, I don't remember it verbatim, but he says that every advancement on the part of blacks throughout our history has always been accompanied by economic development. And don't be afraid to think in billions. You spend billions. You spent over $2 billion in Coca-Cola last year. Coca-Cola. $1 billion and something chewing gum you chewed up. Over $1.5 billion. That's counter-revolutionary. You may have to start out small, but and don't start out with what you like to buy. Look at what the people are buying. And if it's not against your principles, don't sell them no dope. Don't sell them nothing that's going to hurt them. But if it's not against your principles, sell it. Market it. Go out door to door. Look, I didn't plan to get in this, but I'm going into it. I'm not going to be much longer, but y'all, I hope you can sit here and take this in, and not only take it in, but put it to work. There's no more bread man in the black community. There's no more milkman in the black community. There's no more bakery man from door to door in the black community. But we're still purchasing those products, and we're purchasing them from Passmark and everywhere else. There are black farmers in the South losing their land every day because when they go to the market, Kroger will not give them the price that they're asking. And they would rather plow the crops back in the ground. Why don't you have trucks going to the farm just over in Delaware and Jersey, bringing it back? Why don't you have, if you got to rent cold space for the warehouse, why don't you do that? And if you don't have no more than a push cart, bring it from there to the people and put it on the tables of black people. That's revolutionary. You don't think it is. You get into that business, which is a multi-billion dollar business, and see what you have to fight white folks right away. That's why when you set that up, you must also set up your what? Your defense, your military, your security system. Why do you think these men struggled so hard all these years to tell you this? I tell you, it ain't nothing new. Why did the Honorable Marcus Garvey work so hard at this? Why did the Honorable Elijah Muhammad import tons and tons upon tons of fish in? Why? So that you could become self-sufficient, and you can do it. You can do it. Not without a struggle. I hear you say, I'm getting tired of this. I want to throw down. I want to hasten the day of the revolution. Do that and you will. He spoke here about remembering the strikes. The Chinese have kept the signs that was put up that said, for dogs and Chinese only, when the English oppressed them in their land. And that's why we're going over old Nat the Prophet today and some of the events which took place then, so that you can remember and never forget, so that you can teach your children and never forget. Have the Americans let their children forget that they fought for their liberation from England? And why does not your child, why does not every black school, there's not a black school in this country named after Nat Turner? Not one. Why? Because they fear that kind of man. But they're named after George Washington, Nathan L. and all them folks. I'm almost through. I can feel it coming now. He went on to say, think of the torture and disgrace of your noble mothers. Think of your wretched sisters, loving virtue and purity, as they are driven into concubinage and are exposed to the unbridled lust of incarnate devils. You know, that wasn't the first time that they came up when the Honorable Elijah Muhammad told us they was the devil. Does hateful things. That's what a devil is. And he said, think of your mothers. One of the things that greatly impressed Nat Turner is when he was a boy, his baby sister had a cold and she was weak, and a mother was afraid the child was going to die because it was so drafty in those slave quarters back then. So she went and took one of the master's brother's shirt, red flannel shirt. She took it. She had a right to take it. She took it and wrapped her baby in it. And when some field hand told on her, they came and found her and beat that woman to the ground. Took her by her hair, kicked her in her stomach, punched her in her mouth, swollen up her face. Nat's baby's sister lay trembling and crying. Nat as a child lay crying with tears rolling down, holding his baby sister. As his mother took this whipping so she could save her daughter's life. That's not the only mother that has taken those whippings. I remember one day when I was a child of about 7 years old, and you know how dirty children can get playing out in the street. And my mother was washing me in the tub. Might have been a little younger than that. And all this dirt had built up around the tub. You know how it is when you're a child, how dirty it gets, the bathtub ring. And the dirt floating on it. And she got a far away look in her eyes. A very strange look. And I looked at her and I said, Mother, what's the matter? I sensed as a child that something was wrong. She said, my father used to tell me, my grandfather used to tell me of how the white man used to make the slaves drink their water after they took a bath in it. She said, I just thought about that. It just came across my mind. Now, that's just a few of the things that were happening to black people. And why do I say you must never forget? Because when you forget, you become stagnant. You become lazy. I'm not saying that you should operate on the principle of hate and walk around all knotted up inside. Just me and I got to get them. No. You must be at peace within yourself, but you remember these things so that you will always know who you are dealing with. And the only reason why they don't do it to you today is because it's not as easy then. It's not as easy now as it was then. And it's because of men like Nat Turner that it's not as easy. Neither God nor angels or just men command you to suffer for a single moment. Therefore, it is your solemn and imperative duty to use every means, both moral and intellectual, and physical, that will promise success. And I'm going to this here last text now, part of the text, and I'm going to read from Nat Turner and I'm going to close out. As it says here, let be not deceived. God is not mocked. For whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. And that principle is this, the immutable law of karma. What goes around, comes around. That is why Minister Farrakhan and others can stand up and say that America is doomed. America knows that is true. The object of the teachers is not to save America, but to keep you from being crushed in that doom. For the hour is at hand. And I know it's hard for you to conceive because they look so strong to you right now. But I'm going to read one more thing about Nat Turner. Say a little bit more about him. I'm going to close out. And we see here on page 54, Pioneers in Protest by Lerone Bennett. He states thusly, the prototype of 20th century revolutionaries, Nat Turner reminds us that oppression is a kind of coins of its own minting. He reminds us that the first and greatest of all gospels is this, that individuals and social systems always reap what they sow. All things that go around must come around. America doesn't want the black man to come into a knowledge of himself and go on his own. If she meant us any good, it wouldn't bother her for us to do this. Why would she feel the need to unleash a whole COINTELPRO project and millions of dollars, of the taxpayers' dollars, on the Republic of New Africa? Why? When all we ever said was that we were not Americans. We had sense enough to understand that, and we wanted some land of our own where we could build our own. We didn't say we were going to do anything to them. Why, when the Honorable Elijah Muhammad had farms down there in Alabama with cattle and chickens, chickens taste better than Purdue chickens. Why did the white men poison those cattle? Why are they so afraid of the black man getting his own? Why? Because they know, even if you don't know, what your destiny is. Why have they put forth such effort to mess up your mind, to keep you into silly music that won't allow you to think? Why is the white man claiming jazz as America's classical music, as America's only indigenous music? Why is he listening to it in his nightclub while you are out shaking your behind with the lights flashing to somebody saying, yeah, yeah, ooh, baby, baby, and such nonsense as that, while the chords that they are playing in the music come out of the witchcraft rituals of the old druids up in England? Do you know that? Why is he taking the time to manipulate your mind in that condition? Why can't he let you alone? Why did he have to kill Malcolm? Why did he have to kill Martin? Why did he have to hunt down men and women like that? Why? Because your time, your hour is at hand. The kingdom of heaven is at hand. The Father desires to give you the kingdom. Nat read that text that the kingdom of heaven is at hand, and his heart was aflame. And that fateful day on August the 21st, as they met and carried on their revolutionary war, they would have won had it not been for one main factor. And that factor was a lack of discipline on the part of those engaged in the revolutionary struggle. What did I say? A lack of discipline on the part of those engaged in the revolutionary struggle. Learn from that. Just as you are today when nobody can't tell you nothing. Brother or sister come to you and say, now brother, sister. We got to correct it. Nigga, get away from me. Don't tell me nothing. I do what I want to do. You're not free to do what you want to do. My life is wrapped up in your life. And your life is wrapped up in my life. So we have to be able to tell each other something. Your ego is so big, so great, that you can't allow another brother or sister some space. You got to do all the talking. You got to have the only doctrine and the only program for our people. Back in those days, they were 3 miles from Jerusalem. How many miles? From the county seat. And that said, let's press on. I must needs go to Jerusalem. And they said, no, let's rest a while. Look how well we've done. Look how many we got. We have 70 now. We're doing good. Let's celebrate. They had been sipping from the cider vat every place they stopped. It got high. What I say? And they got high. And when you get high, you don't want to do nothing but groove. Because you don't want nobody to blow your high. They were 3 miles from Jerusalem, the county seat, but they didn't want to blow their high. But Nat looked at them and made a fatal mistake. See, slaves need strong leadership. What did I say? Yeah, you do. You need somebody to come in and tell you, you got to stop doing this, you got to stop doing that, you got to clean this up, you got to clean it. Because when they don't do that, you just run wild. You just do some of everything and even call it revolutionary. When you do it, well, the smoking is smoke is revolutionary, you know. And he told them, all right, you can take a rest. And that was the fatal move. White folks, some white folks had gotten away and warned the others. And by the time Nat got his men rallied to fight again, 18 white men met him. They were engaged in battle. The white men ran. They pursued him over the hill and were surrounded by others. Then Nat's forces had to break up. And you know the story from there. It took them 2 months to catch him, too. 2 months to catch him. But that never would have happened if it had not been for a lack of discipline on the part of the revolutionary. What does that say to us today, brothers and sisters? We're only in this situation today because of a lack of mental, spiritual, and physical discipline in our dealings with ourselves and with each other. No, brother, we don't have a long ways to go. It's just down the road. We got to move on it. And that is the message of the Creator for you tonight. I'm reminded of the story as I close out that when Gabriel Prophet was planning one of the greatest slave uprisings in the history of this abominable country. I have no love for America. I never have. What do I have to love in it? And it was a well-planned, well-laid-out plot, except, unfortunately, some undisciplined Negroes told the white man what was going on. But this is one of the systems of communications that they were using back then, which says to me the greatest of all revolutionary principles is that you must be able to make a way out of no way. You must size up and assess the situation and say, it may be a mountain standing between me and it, but I'm going round, under, through, and over. And I'm going to get to my goal. Black man, over 2,000 years ago, about 200 years before the birth of the black Messiah, stood before Snowcap Mountain with the goal of defeating the Roman Empire. And they said, but Hannibal, look at the Alps. And he said, what Alps? And when the Romans looked, elephants and black men with cornrowed hair looking like lions in the face, but dead in their behind at the gates of Rome. And if he had not been betrayed by Massinissa, he would have won that war. And it would have decided the course of history from that day forward. We have so much to learn from that. And then when Gabriel Prosser looked at his situation, white folks now had gotten wind that there was a conspiracy in the air. And they said, well, how did this man reach so many thousands of slaves? I thought they were happy.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we come to the ending of the broadcast. That has been Barashango preaching on Nat Glover, Nat Turner, I'm sorry, and giving us all the background information on that. And we have him inside Tahaka's archives. You can also take a look at his messages and stuff right there on YouTube if you wish. However, the information that we put here for you is designed not only for you to listen to, but to actually use in your life, in everyday life, and to make sure you have it in your mind and you never forget, because this is vital information for us to understand about our ancient story and the things that we have done inside the United States and the way this country was shaped. There's a lot of withholding of information. There are a lot of lies. There's a lot of propaganda, a whole lot of things going on. And what we try to do is separate this and make it as pure and clear for you to understand as we possibly can. We're going to go ahead and close the broadcast this evening. I've been your host, Tahaka Amana L. Bay. And until next time, you all have a good night. Okay.
Children, mothers and fathers, well, all your deacons and priests, brothers and sisters, we got to stand up, come on.